Well, hi, and good afternoon, everybody. This is our 55th program on the rules for magic on the astral plane. And I think you can find these programs now both on YouTube and also on Makara. And we're on page 457 or so, and we're dealing with the last of the rules for the astral plane. So this is our second program on rule one, or rule 11. We've been talking about the requirements for those who wish to precipitate the rain cloud of noble things or some aspects of it that can be worked with. And DK says the aspirant, weary of the eternal round of his own futile and unimportant thoughts, seeks to tap the resources of this rain cloud and so precipitate upon the earth some of the thoughts of God. And in order to do this, well, he wants to work to further bring into manifestation the ideas of the Creator, but there are some requirements, and that's what we've been going over. He has to know the meaning of meditation, align soul, mind, and brain, contemplate, and that really means functioning as a soul on its own plane, and that's a deepened definition of the word contemplation when we usually say, well, I'll go home and contemplate that, you know. Well, there's more to it. We have to actually be able to hold a point of tension on the plane of soul. And then we have to register then an idea received by the soul intuitively, recognize the form it should take. And that, of course, involves clothing it in mental matter and rightly motivating it and precipitating it rightly as part of the magical process. We have to take that idea and reduce it to its essentials. And finally, well, we have to reduce that idea to a blueprint. And that's pretty much found on the plane of the abstract mind. Okay. Well, those are the some of the factors we can ponder those. This, as consciously recorded consciously by the soul upon the mind, is as consciously registered by the mind, held steady in the light. So both soul and mind are registering the idea, and might be regarded as the reduction of the formula to a blueprint. When we talk about blueprints, we're pretty much talking about the work of the abstract mind, the first subplane of the higher mental plane. It is not the formula itself, but a secondary process. And according to the strength, simplicity, and clarity of the embodiment of the formula in a simple outline structure, so will be the finely furnished building and the consequent form, which will confine within the periphery of the outer form itself the lives used in its construction. And that's what we're talking about, confining the form within an ensphering wall. So let's see here. Well, you know, there's so much here of value. Sometimes one can be overwhelmed by just how valuable the presentation is and just about the impossibility of absorbing it at this present time and doing anything with it. But okay, we can do something. The reduction of the formula to the blueprint. And then, so that goes back to the rule, confining within the periphery of the outer form itself, the lives used in its construction. And I'll just read that rule again so we understand the connection with it. Let's see here. Pup, 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 pup. Got a lot of things going. Okay, the periphery, the outer form. So what I want to do is just read that rule again and reference the idea of confinement, containment, and solidification. Three things the worker with the law must now accomplish. First, ascertain the formula which will confine the lives within the ensphering wall. So it's as he says, and then we go on, pronounce the words, and which will tell them what to do and where to carry that which has been made, and finally utter forth the mystic phrase which will save him from their work. So we have the whole idea of the outer form, confined within the periphery of the outer form, the lives used in its construction. And it's not the formula itself, but a secondary process that we're talking about here. Making of the blueprint, first comes the formula and now the blueprint. And according to the strength of this blueprint, so will be the finally furnished building. That's a kind of a Masonic reference, and the consequent form, which will confine within the periphery of the outer form, itself, the lives used in its construction. Right. Okay. Now we don't have, of course, that kind of formula yet. It's not available to us, but okay. Now that takes us to where we begin. With the second program, and it's on page 457. And let me just get the usual necessary brackets. So this in reality resembles the stage of conception, latent within the germ, the result of male-female interrelation. It takes that to make the germ. Lie all the potencies and capacities of the finished product. I remember Rudolf Steiner teaching how to develop the psychic capacities, and he always talked about seeing the tiniest model or archetype of that which had to unfold, to see that first and to nourish that. So here the germ has to be nourished. And all the capacities, all the potencies and capacities of the finished product are within it, latent within the idea which has been materially conceived, but which has been inspired by the spirit aspect. Okay, so really the spirit aspect is the a source anterior even to the soul aspect. Lie hid the potencies and potencies of the finished thought forms. Inspiration is a form of energizing and carrying through to completion the forms for which the higher parts of ourselves, for instance, the spirit, is responsible. The matter aspect, represented by the mind, has been fecundated by the spirit aspect, and the triplicity will eventually be completed by the created form. So I guess what we have is so far the idea of spirit, soul, and mind. But in the early stages, there is as yet only the formula, the conceived idea, the latent yet dynamic concept. It is potent enough to draw to itself the essentials for growth and form, probably from the lower personality fields. Yet, who shall say whether it will prove an abortion, a mediocre and feeble product, or a creation of real beauty and value? So we're at this stage of beginning where the germ is created, the idea is emerging, it's inspired by the highest aspect of ourselves, it's conveyed, it's received by the soul, conveyed to the mind, and in all this process, an outline, a blueprint of what must follow is being formed. So, every externalized idea is, therefore, possessed of a form, animated by desire, and created by the power of the mind. This is, again, the magical process, but inspired from on high and delivered to the mind by the soul, which knows the divine plan. The desire plane is the one upon which the mind imposes its conceptions in order to produce the idea incarnate, to clothe the idea in form. There has to be an intense enough desire to proceed, as it were, downward in order to clothe the idea in the outer form. If one doesn't want to do it, many a good idea will remain simply that and will never take form. It is therefore the gestation ground. So these are important things being said. Here we go. The plane of desire is the, and as he said, gestation ground, where long and slow growth is proceeding on the way into dense manifestation. The mind previously has been the recipient of the archetypal idea as grasped and visualized by the soul. Now, that's really an important statement, because where does that archetypal idea come from anyway? Let's just say, okay, this is important. And it shows a sequence of creativity. The archetypal idea comes from the realm of spirit and its threefold triad. I mean, maybe the Buddhic plane, but the Buddhic plane is not the limitation. It's not the final field in which ideas occur. As a matter of fact, it's one of the lower fields in which ideas occur. In its turn, the soul is the recipient of the formula as presented to it in the world of ideas. Let's just say from the Buddhic plane and above. We can say soul receives the presented idea. You have thus the presented idea, the perceived idea by the soul, and the formulated idea by the mind, abstract and concrete, and the idea working out into manifestation through the magical process we study involving lower mind, astral body, and etheric physical body. Okay, I think in this little sequence, we have the process well presented, well represented. Every externalized idea, now that's the whole idea, well, okay, that's what we're trying to do. Nothing is as powerful as an idea whose time has come, and in the divine plan, ideas are presented from the realm of spirit triad to the soul, to the abstract mind, to the mind, for presentation, further presentation to the world according to right timing, because the cycles are known. So the whole idea, there I go again, of the idea whose time has come is very important for the plan. It's a well-timed process, and the masters are aware of this process. So I'm going to read this little section again. Every externalized idea is therefore possessed of form, the outer form, animated by desire and created by the power of the mind, which crystallizes perhaps the vague and misty idea or, you know, higher thought with which it is presented into something more tangible and concrete. The desire plane is the one upon which the mind imposes its conceptions received from above in order to produce the idea incarnate. Each one of us is, in a way, an idea incarnate, i.e. to clothe the idea in form. So, this desire plane is therefore the gestation ground, the place of long growth and empowerment, so that the thought form, which has been an idea, but now it's become a thought form, can proceed toward incarnation. So we realize we're talking about the process of reincarnation in the case of a human being, and we're talking about some parallel process, which we can call the incarnation of an idea in the mind of the creator. The mind previously has been the recipient of the archetypal idea. Now, of course, what we call generally the soul is on the plane of mind. The mind previously has been the recipient of the archetypal idea as grasped and visualized by the soul. And we wonder whether this blueprint of that which comes from, let's say, the Buddhic plane or higher, is formulated in such a way that the soul will grasp it. Because technically speaking, what we normally call the soul on the higher mental plane is located on the second and third subplanes. And when we're talking about a creator, we're talking about a more advanced type. So then on the second subplane of the higher mental plane, but the abstract mind, which creates the blueprint, is located on the first subplane. So it would make sense that there be a transfer from the Buddhic level to the abstract mental level, to the soul level, to the concrete mental level, then to the astral level, then to the etheric, and finally the physical. I think we cannot violate that particular continuous sequence. In its turn, the soul is the recipient of the formula as presented to it in the world of ideas. I guess that's what that is. And you have thus the presented idea, and let's just say it's from the Buddhic plane and higher. And also the presented blueprint. The perceived idea, perceived by the soul, and the which then presents it to the mind, or formulates it in some manner that the mind can use by the soul, let's say, which formulates the presented idea in a manner which the mind can use to formulate a further concretion, and the formulated idea, which is done by the mind. At this point, I would say more the concrete mind than the abstract mind, because I think that the abstract mind has already gotten into the act and has helped to step down the formula for reception by the soul, or, you know, reception by that part of ourselves which is focused on the second and third subplane of the mental plane, the higher mental plane. And then the working out of the idea into manifestation. So what we have to do is, when we think of the magical process, we oftentimes think, okay, we meditate in relation to the soul, and the solar angel and or its extension is there in the causal body, and some idea takes form, and then it is impressed upon the lower mechanism, which sees to the precipitation of the idea eventually into outer form. But what this little section is telling us about is that before the soul, or our causal nature, or that extension of the solar angel onto the higher mental plane ever receives the idea, there is a higher process which is going on. The idea perhaps is arising on the Buddhic plane, or higher, I keep on saying, because the Buddhic plane is not the only plane within the cosmic ethers where ideas take form. I mean, the ultimate archetypal ideas for the cosmic physical plane are taking shape on the logoic level. And why should we eliminate planes higher than the Buddhic for the origin of ideas? So there is a higher process which feeds the soul and the lower vehicles. I like very much this whole, do I want to say concept, or do I want to say thought? I want to be careful about using the word idea. So you have, you know, in a way you have the, you have thus the, I want to say origination of the idea, the arising of the idea on the Buddhic plane or higher. So the origination of the idea, I'm going to make that quite big. I know I'm taking a lot of time on this, but it seems necessary to get it clear. Then you have the presented idea, which is going to be given to the soul, probably via the abstract mind, if the sequence holds good. And then we have the perceived idea, and it's perceived by the soul, or at least that faculty of consciousness which we have on the second and third subplanes of the higher mental plane. And then there's a further presentation or impression, maybe I should call it that. Okay, here's the presented idea and the formulated idea. Let's just say the mind will formulate, but what do you do with the perceived idea? Okay, so the blueprint, the perceived idea by the soul, etc. Note, there is a kind of impressed idea by the soul upon the lower mind. And there, after that, further formulation occurs. Okay, well, I hope I'm being as clear as possible. It is a little bit intricate, There it is. Impressed idea. So let's just make a kind of a sequence here. Originating idea, presented idea, perceived idea. I'm including some of my own formulations here. Impressed, okay, perceived idea, first phase of formulation. Well, it's not really the first phase. There's a kind of a phase, originating idea, presented idea, originating idea, presented idea, from the plane of origination plus the type of abstract blueprint formulation in the abstract mind, the perceived idea by the soul, the second phase of formulation in the soul, the impressed idea, and the further formulation and solidification of the idea by the concrete mind, and then the precipitating process. So I'm hoping the phase of formulation in the soul, not the foal, not the soul. All right, so I'm going to, let's just call this a sequence by means of which the arising idea becomes an outer form. All right, so let's make that quite big, and so that we can go to it if we need to. And there it is. I think, you know, obviously it's taking me some pondering to grasp this, and I think it will take all of us some pondering. But, you know, we're not meant to just fly into action. Even the artist of the future is meant to meditate first, not just suddenly, spontaneously come forth with what is probably an astral form, but occultly to meditate and to touch the realm of ideas, which have to be precipitated in some beautiful presentation. So everything is much more deliberate, involving meditation in the future. And the magical process, white magical process, or really any magical process, but the white magical process goes higher, is a very deliberate process. So oftentimes I just feel, you know, let's just ponder on these things until more light emerges. But the whole thing, let's just say, let us remember that the monad or spirit is involved in this precipitation of needed forms from the rain cloud of noble things. I don't have one for that. Rain cloud of noble things. Well, I do, only it is in capitals. So that's the one fault there, rain cloud of noble things. And the finished thought form will emerge. Now, in the age of Aquarius, we have to remember that the sign Aquarius rules the very lowest of the creative hierarchies, which is etheric in its nature. And so Aquarius can be considered a sign of spiritualized materialism. Not materialism per se, which is a blinding condition, but the use of matter to bring into demonstration or appearance or visibility or tangibility some high idea, some high being, because a being is an idea, idea is a being, which is part of the divine plan, and to bring it into tangibility at the right time. That is what has to be done. Now, I'm, you know, a pretty thorough type, but one can just go too far with thoroughness. So I leave it to you to dig into this further if you wish to. And I guess we all should wish to, because somehow we have here a sequence which arises from the appearance of the idea whose time has come, all the way down to the tangible formal representation of that idea. It is well to bear in mind, oh, what a relief to go on, huh? It is well to bear in mind that the following factors govern the emergence of the idea out of the universal mind into the world of tangible forms. Well, okay, now, the Buddhic plane is not the highest of the planes of universal mind. The atmic plane is higher, as is the monadic plane and the logoic plane, is, yeah. And if we really want to find universal mind, we will have to reference the cosmic mental plane. Because in this case, let's just say, in this case, the solar system is the universe. It's a rather circumscribed use of the word, and the mind, both higher and lower of the solar logos, can be called universal mind. But anyway, let's see how he presents this. The emergence of the idea out of the universal mind. Well, because, you know, really it is the solar logos' plan. Now, the planetary logos is part of the solar logos. Everything's part of everything else, you know, so there's no such thing as a independent being, or a being independent from being. Okay, let me just put that down as it might be an idea. There is no such thing as a being independent from being. I guess we could ponder on that. No being has really an independent existence. It's all, every being is fed by the greater branching or of emanated being, or well, the streams of emanated being feed every being and connected, and there's no such thing as a detached being. There is no such thing as a detached being. Now, and the attitude of detachment, that's different. I'm not talking about that. But I'm talking about from the ontological point of view, I'm talking about the life point of view, the idea of the sustainment of any expression of being can never be detached from the root of being. And the root of being finally is the absolute, but let's just stay within the universe here. And we find the beingness of the universal logos, and no emanation of that universal logos is detached from the original, from that one universal life. So all beings are related to the one universal life. Looks like part of an owl or a soul. One universal life. And one universal life. Okay. Well, you never can tell when a tangent will come. But anyway, the following factors govern the emergence of the idea out of the universal mind and into the world of tangible forms. So, you know, we're being told in many ways how to become a white magician. The magician who is simply a mental magician and interested in the life of form only does not touch the heights and does not wish to precipitate that which is found upon the heights. There is a stopping point in the ascent of the search for what is to be precipitated. And I think a relatively low form, out of alignment with the divine plan, is what ends up being precipitated. But now we go further and we say the following factors govern this emergence. Number one, the energies emanating from the archetypal plane. Now, what is that archetypal plane? I've been kind of referencing that, hinting that either the monadic or the logoic plane. And of course, the logoic plane is a still more powerful and recessed archetype than possesses those compared to what's found on the monadic plane, which is simply derivative. The forms that beings take are derivative from the planes above it. Okay, so in a way, you know, the highest part of Shambhala, as it works out at least on the cosmic physical plane, are found on the logoic plane, and that's the plane of the archetypes. This plane is the focus of the attention of the highest group of intelligences on our planet. We never know whether we're talking about a globe, you know, because we would say in our scheme, is this a globe or the entire scheme? Is this a globe, a chain, or an entire scheme? So, you know, let's say Sanat Kumara, as an extension of the planetary logos, must be one of them. Must be one of these highest intelligences, and the planetary logos, the highest with regard to our planetary PSC. Goodness, I had a planetary scheme once. PSCH. Well, I'm just going to make it up then. let's call it planetary, and I'll find the other one somewhere else. Scheme, P-S-C-H. Their consciousness, these high beings, there is apparently an emanation even higher than Sanat Kumara, who administers the sixth initiation, we are told, somewhere in that, easy book, Initiation Human and Solar. And then, of course, the planetary logos himself, and there are the various Kumaras. They are the high beings. Their consciousness can respond and be inclusive to this sphere of activity whereon the mind of God expresses itself free from the limitations of what we understand as form. You know, maybe what we understand is form, but there are probably forms that we don't understand. In a way, the whole universe is a form, as refined as the higher levels of it may be. So the what we're talking about here, it's always good to remind ourselves, these are the factors which govern the emergence of the idea out of the universal mind and the energies emanating from the archetypal plane, and I just think it's logoic, really. Their consciousness can respond and be inclusive to this sphere of activity whereon the mind of God expresses itself free from the limitations of what we call form. And I just want to say that as far as the cosmic physical plane goes, this plane of which we are speaking is is probably the logoic plane. They are the custodians of the formula. These high beings. They are the custodian of the formula. They are the mathematicians who prepare the blueprints of the great plan. They calculate the effects of the forces with which the work is carried forward and the energies which must be manipulated. They allow for the strains and stress. It sounds like building a bridge, doesn't it? Or some, great edifice in one of our big cities. Material strains and stresses. They allow for the strains and stresses to which the forms must be subjected under the impact of the life force. They deal with the cyclic impulses to which the evolutionary process must respond. They have a lot of knowledge. They concern themselves with the relation between the form aspect and the life urge. These great beings, who are emanating, I suppose, or involved in the emanation of the archetypes from the highest plane on the cosmic physical plane. But, you know, when DK talks about what they do, we see how far beyond the ken, the abilities of what we call man today, are their tasks. So they have the formula of the idea, we might say. They have the formula of, I'm hoping I can do this, of the archetype which must work out. They have this advanced form of mathematics that can bring the archetype closer to expression. And here we do see, when we're talking about blueprints, that probably the blueprints are formulated above the level of what we call soul. They calculate, it sounds, you know, the cosmic mathematics, it sounds like those who are on the path of absolute sonship and are possessed of the cosmic mathematics. But of course, you know, these beings actually have been planetary logoi, some of them, in the past, and they are very advanced on the ray path, others of them. And I imagine they work together, each with their expertise. So I imagine the Kumaras are involved here and the ray lords, and the planetary logos as well. The effect of the forces with which the work is carried forward and the energies which must be manipulated, they take everything into consideration, you know, consideration. They allow for the strains and the stresses. They know about the forms and the forces and how much any form or force can bear and keep its integrity. They keep things from falling apart so the archetypal embodiment will not be destroyed. They have to know what's coming in, you know, in terms of what energies are cyclically going to appear and how much stress and strain these appearing energies will place upon what is a under process of creation. And they concern themselves with the relation between, in general, the form aspect, which is in proper in process of precipitating, and the life urge. And we all know that if there's too much of the of what we call life with regard to any form, the form will be destroyed. So too much, quote, life in relation to any form will destroy it, and too little will see the form vitiated and wilting, you know. It's so much of this is about a middle path that can keep the balance, bring the purpose as planned into manifestation, and not destroy the various forms which are on the path to realizing or presenting the objective. I guess we just have to have an idea of what the magical process is and how it works from above to below, but through very definite, well understood steps, at least well understood by the teachers, and we have to come to understand them too when we're making our presentations of whatever high idea we've been able to touch on the physical plane, as long as that high idea or thought, let's say, probably more likely, is in line with as much of the divine plan as we can conceive. All right. So the following factors govern the emergence. Govern the emergence. And I think, you know, it's well to just make that big of the idea. So energies from the archetypal plane and directed, manipulated by great planetary beings, the highest beings on our planet. Let's just say great planetary beings manipulate these energies, beings which are the highest beings on our planet, the highest. Okay, well, you know, it's just a tiny sphere, relatively speaking. The whole process gets bigger and bigger as we consider the larger and larger structures, but okay, it's more than enough for us to handle, for sure. Now, so good to see that my chronometer has not yet failed me. I keep on waiting. It's a sneaky little machine, and it dies just when I want to have a count. Now, what about the intuitional state of awareness? We might say that's the Buddhic plane, particularly, and the fourth sublevel. Of the Buddhic plane. On this level of consciousness, we find the masters of the wisdom carrying out on their work, and we might say, especially the masters on the 2, 4, 6 line. And it is in this sphere of influence that they work with the greatest ease. And facility, as much so as normally intelligent man works on the physical plane. Well, that's interesting. There is an analogy here. The Buddhic plane is like the Buddhic plane when compared to the three higher cosmic ethers is like a physical plane. And if we go to the let's see on no on the systemic level, the dense physical plane also has three planes above it, in this case, etheric, astral, and lower mental. Okay. So the masters, now we're not talking anymore about the very highest beings on our planet who do all these amazing mathematical things involving tremendous foresight regarding the created energies or the formulated energies and the impinging energies. When I read that, I think it's just an amazing job that they have, and so far beyond, you know, what we really can do. But now the masters are working down a few levels. Let's say that the logoic plane is really, as far as the archetypal plane, as far as the cosmic physical plane is concerned, the archetypal plane. Now we're on the Buddhic plane, which is called, the intuitional awareness. Now, of course, on the monadic plane too, and on the higher planes, we do gain intuitional awareness, but the Buddhic plane is particularly known as the plane of intuitional awareness. So the minds, their minds, the minds of these masters are constantly in touch with the archetypal minds, who are the custodians of the formula. And they, taking the blueprints, I speak again in symbolic fashion, deal with the specifications, look for those suitable for the control of the work, and assemble the needed personnel. So let's just say here the work of the masters is much more concrete. Oh, okay. Whoop. All right. So the work of the masters is much more concrete than that of the, and I love this term, archetypal, okay, what have we got here? Archetypal minds. That's a really interesting term. Now let's see. I think though I have to go back. I think I have to go back because I've managed to lose something, you know, for sure. So let's see. Just bear with me. Okay. What do they do? How far back can I go? Okay, right, there it is. And I think I can put that in, that archetypal mind's idea, because it pretty well describes the types of beings that we have been referencing in the first case, who are working from the archetypal plane, which let us think of as the logoic plane and the plane on which Shambhala is found, or at least the higher aspect, highest aspect of Shambhala. So now, let's see if I haven't left anything out. I hope I haven't. We're getting near the 1 hour mark. And it's pretty intricate, you know, in this easy preliminary book. Among their disciples, they, the masters, search until they find the one most suited to be the focal point of information on the physical plane. You know, I suppose the search for Alice Bailey in that case, or H.P. Blavatsky, or the group most eligible to carry into manifestation the desired part of the plan. They work with those so chosen, impressing upon their minds that eternal triplicity of idea, quality, form. And, you know, in Esoteric Psychology 1, in EP1, he calls this triplicity life, quality, appearance. So quality retains its middle position. Appearance is form, and idea is life. Until the details begin to emerge and the work of what is literally a precipitation can go forward. I think, you know, we're really dealing in this rule a lot with the magical process. It's so much about making things appear and disappear, you know. The degraded performances of modern day magicians have everything to do with now you see it, now you don't, you know. But here is a more occult presentation of a higher process, which is the prototype of the here it is, here it isn't. So they're searching, and they, it said that they had to look a long time for Blavatsky, but of course she was related to Master R and as Cagliostro, and she was certainly related to Master M, so they knew of her. So I can't quite put those two ideas together. Anyway, we have the archetypal minds and the masters. Okay, so two kinds of workers are discussed in these first two paragraphs. The, I'll capitalize it this time, archetypal minds and the masters. And they work on different levels. And interesting how concrete, relatively, and how practical is the work of the masters compared with the great formulators on the logoic plane. I mean, what's good about this is to realize that our magical process and what we have to see precipitated begins on very high levels as a result of the work of very high beings. Okay, well, this takes us to one hour. 1 hour has passed, and we continue. I have another program tonight, but I'm trying to get all this in, stealing time. And then comes the activity of the mental state of consciousness. So the sequence is, let's call it logoic, buddhic, and mental. This sequence precedes, or maybe I should call it proceeds, towards dense, oh goodness, TOWS, density. Okay, proceeds towards density. Okay. Now, how do you say, there it is, got two E's. Okay, then the activity of the mental state. Now we're not dealing anymore with the Buddhic state per se, is on the mental plane. It is on the mental plane that much of this work is necessarily done, and here is the reason sufficient for the development on the part of the aspirant of a trained intellect. If you want to become a magician working in line with the plan, a precipitator of that which our planetary God intends, the intellect must be trained. Now, we've learned, to precipitate aspects of the rain cloud of noble things. Certain requirements are indeed necessary. The rain cloud of noble things precipitates, first of all, on the mental plane. It comes from, of course, it comes from the cosmic ethers and above. And a further precipitation goes forward when disciples and aspirants are the recipients. So, getting something down into form from the higher levels is a very systematic process, not easy. These aspirants and disciples, these latter in their turn, seek to impress and guide the lesser workers and aspirants who karmically or by choice lie within their radius of influence. Thus, the idea presented is seized upon by many minds, and the formula aspect of the great work has played its part. It's not the pure idea, but it's what sort of lies within and behind the idea. Okay. So many minds seize and take that idea together. I think it takes sometimes quite a few dedicated workers working together to bring the idea into form. Okay. It will be seen how this work is consequently and essentially group work. One person alone cannot do it, even if that person has a great idea, as they say. It takes a whole hierarchy of descending forces to bring it onto the physical plane in the right form. So it will be seen how this work is consequently and essentially group work, and is therefore only truly possible for those who have somewhat mastered the meditation process and can hold the mind steady in the light. This work of precipitation. So this is a requirement. And unless we can meditate somewhat and hold the mind steady in the light, let's just say that otherwise we cannot perform this magical work of precipitation. The light in reality streams forth from the universal mind. Now we talked about at what level we find that, and you know that we might have to go all the way onto the cosmic planes before we really find the mind, the lower mind and higher mind of the Logos, but we can find some kind of etheric representation of that mind on the cosmic physical plane, and probably even on the cosmic astral plane, on one of the subplanes. So this light in reality streams forth from the universal mind and is of varying kinds and was, esoterically speaking, generated in a previous solar system and must be used and developed in this one. Now, let's just see. Yeah. That previous solar system was a system of mind, and its number was 5, and it was building the mental capacities of our solar Logos. But now there must be an application of that mental light to produce the loving cohesiveness which is required in this system, right relationships, you might say. In a way, the whole solar system that we're in, which is the second major and fifth minor, is to produce right relationships between all levels of expression. So, right relationships is the key to the goal of our solar system. Well, you know, and there are there are right relationships within. Sorry. And right relationships without. And finally, you know, the consummation in our solar system has to be a great expression of solar logoic love, having produced such a unity that the oneness, which will be absolutely characteristic of the next solar system, will already be very evident. Well, who can speak of the next solar system? We know it's going to be a solar system of will. And as I thought about this, I said, well, how can that be? And I would say, well, then the solar logos then has to take a first-ray personality, even as he has taken a second-ray personality in this solar system with his second-ray soul, and probably took a third-ray personality in the previous solar system. All right. So, just summarizing here. We have here the energies from the archetypal plane, that is, this is all about how an idea emerges from the universal mind, what kinds of things govern it, and There's work done on the archetypal plane, we'll call it logoic. There's work done on the Buddhic plane, the stage of intuitional awareness. And I'll, you know, as usual, try to give it a size befitting its importance. And finally, there is the activity of the mental state of consciousness. Now, even the Buddhic plane can be called, from a certain perspective, mental, because it's called the realm of a transcendental mind. It's Mercurian in that respect. But we're talking about the mental plane per se, maybe divided into three parts. The abstract mind as the first sub-level of the higher mental plane, and the simply the higher mind being sub-level 2 and 3, and the concrete mind being sub-levels 4, 5, 6, and 7. And all of those have to form one seamless unity eventually. Okay, so let's see where we are now. In the words, in the light of the intuition, we have conveyed to our minds that type of energy which embodies the purpose, the will of God, the plan as we regard it. In the words, the light of the intuition is the direct apprehension of what that which the planetary logos intends. And, you know, we have much less contact with the intuition than we may imagine, because we use the word loosely all the time. But if you go to the beginning of your Glamour World Problem book, he sets out the distinctions between illumination and wisdom and intuition. I won't go there right now, but, or should I? You know, I'm always finding that, in fact, it may be good to go someplace where, let's just see, certain preliminary clarifications, definition of the intuition. Well, it's such a good definition. So intuition is the synthetic understanding, which is the prerogative of the soul. And remember, the true soul is the triad. And it only becomes possible when the soul on its own level is reaching in two directions, towards the monad and towards the integrated, and perhaps even if only temporarily coordinated and at one personality. It is the first indication of a deeply subjective unification, which will find its consummation at the third initiation, but even not much intuition developed before that, because although there is one reference that seems to show the Buddhic vehicle being coordinated before the third initiation, that type of coordination in other references is shown to occur after the third initiation. So intuition really goes much farther than the third initiation. This is wonderful, you know, and I always recommend that people go back to page 3 and 4 and 5 of this Glamour World Problem. Intuition is a comprehensive grip of the principle of universality. And when it is functioning, there is momentarily, at least, a complete loss of the sense of separateness. And, why am I reading this? It's so good, you know. At its highest point, it is known as universal love, which has no relation to sentiment or to the affectional reaction, but is primarily in the nature of identification with all beings. And then he starts to deal with the results of truly being intuitive. Okay, well, I just went against my own better judgment, I'm not sure. But go there, page 3, you know, page 4, illumination, wisdom, knowledge. All of these things are foundationally defined, in a very, very clear way. And I find myself going over and over them just to make sure that I really, really understood what is being said. I have these things imprinted in my mind so I do not stray into lesser definitions. Illumination is here, and understanding is here, and love is here, and what else? Well, that's quite a bit right there. And I think somewhere there's some discussion about wisdom, Anyway, page 2, page 3, page 4, right in the beginning of this book. So we've just looked at the words in the light of the intuition. And it's conveying something quite high. Purpose, will of God, the plan. These are the great archetypes, the direction, and the relationships which must be established. Then we have the words, in the light of the soul, we have an expression which sums up the purpose, the plan, and the will of those entities who, incarnated in human form and at times functioning out of the body, have the responsibility of materializing the divine concepts in the fourth kingdom of nature. I mean, it sounds like the initiates, doesn't it? Does to me, the higher initiates and the masters. So in the words light of the soul, we have an expression which sums up the purpose, the plan, the will of those entities who incarnated in human form, as the masters are, and at times functioning out of the body, as they do, who have the responsibility of materializing the divine concepts in the four kingdoms of nature, lower kingdoms, and pretty much working on the lower 18 and 21 subplanes. Okay, so working primarily on the lower 18 or 21 subplanes. The human kingdom is par excellence the medium of expression for the universal mind. Well, from this perspective, maybe we can understand it that the human monads are found expressing on the Buddhic plane, even though their plane of origin on the cosmic physical plane can be more properly understood as the monadic plane. So the kingdom, human kingdom, is par excellence the medium of expression for the universal mind. We have on that Buddhic plane, we have our planet, which is Mercury. Mercury is very much the planet of humanity, just as we might say Venus is the planet for the Deva kingdom. And what do I mean here? Let me give an example. If I can find it. Yeah, it's over here. And basically, 1, 2, 3, 4. There it is. Okay. So here we have the human hierarchy, the initiates, the lords of sacrifice. Their monads are on the second plane, grouped together in seven great categories. But their area of work is on the Buddhic plane. And here it is, see. Human hierarchy, initiates, lords of sacrifice. Also, maybe the lowest plane of the solar angel in its entirety, not in its partial extensions, is the Buddhic plane. Maybe that is so. Well, I'm not sure about this this chart, whether it was assembled by DK or somehow I have the impression or have been told that it was assembled by students and he gave the okay on it. Maybe. But anyway, it is, I think, authoritative, and I think we can trust it and work with it. All right. Excuse me. The human kingdom is par excellence, the medium of expression for the universal mind, and okay. And when the sons of God in human form are perfected, the problems of the natural world will be solved in large measure. So let's just say that we, we human monads are on a mission of redemption. And are seeking to help solve, are seeking to help solve the problems of the natural world, the lower 18 subplanes. The fully conscious sons of God, aware of themselves whilst in human form, and they are few as yet, constitute literally the brain of the planetary life. And this is something that it might be easy to forget. And I suppose it could include the high initiates and masters, I suspect. That's one way to look at it. Let's say this is important and probably includes the initiates and masters. So they are fully conscious. They work in human form, and they are very few as yet, yes. Although more fifth-degree initiates will be needed, and they constitute the brain of the planetary life. New Group of World Servers, the Agent Center, Humanity, we're talking etherically, the Throat Center, or maybe some, the Agent Center. And now we're coming down physically, and we're talking about the planetary life. So some are centers in Sanat Kumara, but when we talk about the planetary life, when we speak of the planetary life, we are speaking of the planetary logos in its entirety. So it's a bigger sphere or field, I would say. I wonder if we can realize how very rich this book is. I'm certainly realizing it in a way that I had not before, and how very intricate is the presentation, and how much in need of review. There probably won't be so many who are reading through with me these books, and they may well be doing it, let's say, after the presentation of the third dispensation has begun. But if that begins to occur, that reading through, that thinking through on your own or with me before the era of the Forerunner ends in 2025, then let it be known that this careful reading, even though obviously many interpretations, my own included, will be inaccurate is necessary. And it's very easy to sort of be in the work and let go of the let go of the finer points that are found in the book and not give the necessary attention to them. But let us be meticulously and tyrus. I don't know. You can't really use words like that, but he says that one of the aspects of the second ray of a certain type is meticulous entirety. So let us approach DK's meticulous entirety, even though he has presented to us what he calls only the ABCs. Let us approach it with as much meticulous entirety as we can bring to bear. There is a truly occult significance to the words to throw light upon a problem, a condition, or a situation. We're talking about, you know, the light of the intuition. We're talking about the light of the soul. And now we're talking about throwing light upon a problem. It is, in its essential meaning, it connotes the revelation of the presented idea of the principle which underlies the outer manifestation, revelation. Okay. So, you know, so does what lies behind and within a presented idea, show itself, or can it be detected? Maybe with spiritual discernment is one of the powers that can help us. So can we see the cause, the archetype behind and within the presented form and symbolic reading will help us, sometimes called spiritual reading. It is the recognition of the inner and spiritual reality which produces the outer and visible form. Well, we have to get used to seeing all things in their symbolic nature. A thing must lead to its impelling idea. That is, every phenomenon must be pursued until it reveals its noumenon. So I'll say that every phenomenon must be pursued until its noumenon is revealed. This is the keynote of all work in symbolism. The work of ascertaining the formulas or drawing up the subjective charts or plans of the of intuitive impression and of intense activity on the mental plane is the sole work of the organized planetary hierarchy. So they become custodians of the plan. I'll read it again. The work of ascertaining the formulas, which have been, you know, let's say, generated by the archetypal minds, as they've been called, of drawing up the subjective charts of plans of intuitive impression, the subjective charts or plans of intuitive impression and of intense activity on the mental plane, is the sole work of the organized planetary hierarchy. The second phase of the work, modify, qualify, and adapt the form. So the adapters and the modify, qualify, and adapt, yes, are closer to the tangible worlds. The second phase of the work is carried on by those workers who, cooperating consciously with the hierarchy, demonstrate the reality of that work in the three worlds of human evolution, and that's where we, I think, find ourselves, not as masters, but as those who can bring what the masters have intuited, what they've created or discovered as the internal charts of that which must appear. We are the ones who can take that further into manifestation. Yeah, modify, qualify, and adapt the plan. That's it. Sorry. So, ascertaining the formulas. So what do we have? Archetypal minds work with the arising of an idea, or an idea is arising, timed within the cycles of great archetypal beings. The planetary logos knows when an idea must arise. The archetypal minds are determining the formulas behind the idea, and they're going to make sure that the disciples and initiates receive some impression that they can work out for more tangible demonstration. Okay, so this second phase of the work, they bring the germ of the idea and the embryonic concept into outer and completed existence through the process of right thought, the awakening of desire, which brings it closer to tangible appearance, and the nurturing of right public opinion. And why would that be? That's interesting. So let's think about that. And that's to create a receptive environment which is not hostile. Okay, so in order, let's just say, in order to create a receptive environment which is not hostile, to the appearance of the idea in form, you know. Otherwise, rejection, immediate rejection, and possible destruction can occur. Thus, they bring about the needed physical activity, let's just say, on the part of those who must receive the idea on the physical plane, and have that idea in tangible form condition their lives. Well, you know, there are always going to be reactionaries. They react to the new out of the love of the past, the bias which instantaneously preserves that to which they are accustomed, that preserves the conditions as they have known them. They don't even think through what the new presentation could mean. And we're dealing with that right now as the reactionaries adhere to the Piscean ways of proceeding, which are really at this point quite crystallized because we're in the negative phase of the sixth ray cycle and probably of the Piscean cycle. And they resist the impartation of the new, which seems to threaten all that they hold dear. You know, if a person trained in spiritual occultism has a conversation to try to open up the mind of a doctrinaire, a Christian or Muslim or who knows what, you know, and tries to explain a deeper design that may have been fathomed by such a person holding tenaciously to certain dogmas and creeds, it oftentimes just isn't successful. And probably a number of us have had this experience, I suspect. Okay, so, you know, we're really being taught the ABCs of how it's done, you know, how we get that, all this down to earth, how it all gets coordinated, how the light of the intuition and the light of the soul work together to help bring down the ideas, and how the formulas behind that which is to be presented are known to the higher minds, and they work with these formulas to bring forth the best possible presentation. If we can't hold the mind steady in the light, we can't really participate in this, and in order to bring through what must be brought through in line with the plan, the group is required. So we are entering the age of group activity, particularly in Aquarius, for the next 2500 years, let's say, and then a longer Aquarian age of a Platonic year for 25,000 years. So the whole movement towards the group reception and presentation of the idea will be there, and those who are working on the higher levels, working as archetypal minds, are also working as a group. I mean, we really have to think that, of course, the seven ray lords are working together as a group, and the Buddhas of activity as a group, and the esoteric Kumaras as a group, and the Buddhas and the esoteric Kumaras as a group, and all of this somehow including Sanat Kumara. That's so all the different aspects can be covered and are not overlooked, because everybody has to uphold a part of the descending archetype. Aspirants, group leaders, and thinkers in all parts of the globe can be available for this work, provided their minds are open and focused. And what can we call this work? You know, bringing into tangible form the ideas, how am I going to say this? Because an idea is a living being anyway. The ideas, I'll just say whose time has come. We're told that they are beings incorporeal. They're, you know, they have soul, they live. They're not just something that a human being thought up. Ideas descend from above, and so often in normal human language, we speak about ideas as if we human beings have somehow, through our thought process, created them. It's rather the ideas that create our thought process. According to the simplicity of their approach to truth, according to the clarity of their thought, according to their group influence and state of inclusive awareness, and according to their power for long sustained effort, will be the approximation of the outer form to the inner idea and the spiritual subjective reality. Well, you know, we're here in what I call the mosaic world, the world of becoming, And in this mosaic world, we need a seamless representation of the archetype. So I'll just kind of say that, you know, all the parts and pieces have to be aligned properly, but then the divisions between them have to be negated. In the mosaic world, there must be a seamless approximation to the seamless archetypes from the archetypal worlds. We're busy arranging the parts and pieces to reflect the great design that is found higher in the cosmic ethers. We'll just have to stick to that at the moment. That's our noumenal world. What's going on the cosmic astral plane? If the Tibetan says that he himself has not been there, then all we can know is that it exists and maybe certain great energies emanate from it. So we measure ourselves, we test ourselves. Do we have this simple approach to truth? And clarity of thought? And can we work in group formation as a productive, constructive, integral member of a spiritually inclined group? And are we inclusive in our awareness? Or do we gain our strength, so we think, by shutting things out? You know, basically a lot of the sixth ray types are so narrow, they're saying, you know, get rid of that. I don't want to know it. It confuses me. I know what I'm certain of. I want to hold on to that. Don't complicate my mind and make me feel insecure. It's all based on fear, really. Can we work hard and long? Well, we have to work at bringing about the approximation of the outer world to the inner world. I think that's a simple way of putting it. The point I seek to make is that the average reader of these instructions has nothing to do with the formulas. Yeah, recently there's been some discussion about becoming aware of the Black Lodge and all that. I just... as he says, speculation anent which is both profitless and dangerous, and we pretty well have to leave that to Shambhala, but people like to enter into things that where they have no business going instead of perfecting their own character and their own meditative practice. In a few days, I'll have to say something unwelcome. Okay, well, anyway, the point I seek to make is these instructions, the average reader has nothing to do with the formulas. They are, every archetype is a formula, you know, we might say. Is a formula. They are grasped and understood by the great knowers, who stand back of the evolutionary process and are responsible for its functional activity. Knowers of greater scope and power than even the masters, although some masters may be included in this. The hierarchy of masters, of the senior initiates and disciples, is proceeding steadily with that work, some of it anyway, you know, but the great archetypal minds are even beyond them. But the registrants of the custodians of the plan, Yeah, they can be members of the hierarchy. And the very highest ones, like the three great lords, can be registrants of the purpose. But they're proceeding with that work, but is dependent under the law upon those on the physical plane who are to produce the outer forms. Okay, well, the greater looks around and realizes that the work can be hampered by the inadequacy of those who have to carry it further into physicality. I think that there are many disciples who are learning this in relation to their work with average, relatively non-aspiring human beings. And the masters learn this again and again, or see it in relation to the likes of us. So, if those upon the physical plane who are to produce the outer forms, maybe such as we are, if we fail to respond, there will be a delay or incorrect building. If they make mistakes, there will be lost time and energy and delay again. If they lose interest and cease to work or are primarily interested in their own affairs and personalities, the plan will have to wait. And energy, which would otherwise be made available for the solving of human problems and the guidance of humanity, will have to find its outlet in other directions. There is never anything static in the creative process. Energy, which is flowing in the pulsation of the one life and its rhythmic and cyclic activity, never ending and never resting, and never beginning too, must be somewhat utilized and must find its way in some direction. Often, when a man fails in his duty, with catastrophic results. Now, let's just see if I can go here and look at the phrase with catastrophic results. And there's only one. And let's see if we can find it. Right. An outlet. Yeah, I get it. So it these outer agencies are used, and the energy pours through them, but there can be catastrophes if the man fails to react rightly to what is passing through him. So an outer point may fail to rightly receive and express the higher energies which are coming through him. But outlet must be found. So, this puts a lot of pressure on the likes of us. What does he say here? That the problem of cataclysms, the cause, for instance, of the steadily increasing insect peril, will be found to be related to the inflow of unused and unrecognized energy, which is capable of right direction and right purpose, and for the furthering of the plan, if the aspirants and the disciples of the world shoulder their group responsibilities, submerge their personalities, and achieve true realization. Well, that gives us pause, doesn't it? It gives me pause, I tell you that. I want to be the kind of worker that can be depended upon, and naturally I want the workers who work with me, who may know a little less or have a little less experience with the teaching, to also be willing to try to work as correctly as possible. So the outer beings can cause problems for those who know on the inner side. I'm speaking of the masters here, and we as disciples. If they, we, fail to respond, there will be delay or incorrect building. If they make mistakes, they, we, there will be lost time and energy, and again delay. If they lose interest and cease to work, or primarily interested in their own affairs and personalities, the plan will have to wait, and energy which would otherwise be made available for the solving of human problems and the guidance of humanity will have to find its outlet in other directions. And there's never anything static in the creative process. Energy which is flowing forth in the pulsation of the one life, you know, the first ray somehow operates through pulsation, and its rhythmic and cyclic activity, never ending and never resting, must be somewhere utilized and must find its way in some direction. And it does, but often when a man fails in his duty, you know, lets go of his Saturn, doesn't follow through, doesn't live up to the responsibility, often with catastrophic results. And then cataclysms, maybe earthquakes, volcanoes, insects, all kinds of anomalies and perils in the outer environment have to do with unused energy. Well, okay. Humanity must be more diligent and more intelligent in the working out of its true destiny and karmic obligations, but don't know why that happens, you know. Okay. But first, it must know something of what is happening and its responsibilities within the process. Responsibilities. Oh, well, this is what we can do. When men are universally en rapport with the custodians of the plan, remember the registrants of the purpose and the custodians of the plan, and we might say on the atmic plane, and their minds and brains are illumined by the light of the intuition of the soul and of the universal mind, higher yet, when they can train themselves to respond intelligently to the timely, you know, the right time has come, to the timely impulses which cyclically emanate from the inner side of life, then there will be a steady adjustment between life and form and a rapid amelioration of world conditions. Well, he's laying a bit of a burden on us, isn't he? He's saying, well, we're just not diligent enough. I think every disciple has to take this to heart. It is an interesting point to hear. It is an interesting point to hear in mind. Bear in mind, I'll bet. You know, mistakes, bear in mind. That the first effect of the response of the more advanced of the sons of men to the formulas as translated and transmitted by the knowers, into what? Into blueprints and transmitted, impressed upon the soul by the knowers will be the establishing of right relations between the four kingdoms of nature and the right relations between units and groups in the human family. That's a very encouraging thought. And already you see people really working with the lower kingdoms and with humanity in the way suggested here. Now, you know, it's basically that great shambolic theme. Somewhere. Okay, 1, 2. And we can call this establishing. Where am I? Okay, here we are. Establishing right human relations. A step in this direction is being made. Okay, and this is, remember, almost 90 years ago. Relations between the four spheres of activity, which we call human, animal, vegetable, and mineral, are now badly adjusted because the energy of matter is primarily the governing factor. In other words, the tail is wagging the dog here. The lower is determining the direction and not the higher. The lower kingdoms of nature are directing what should be a much more conscious development, or at least led consciously by humanity, who itself is the victim of materialism. In the human kingdom, the working of this energy demonstrates in what we call selfishness. Okay, in the animal kingdom, it demonstrates in what we call cruelty, though where the sense of responsibility is non-existent and only instinctual and temporary, and only instinctual and temporary parental responsibility is found, there is no criticism to be given. In the vegetable kingdom, this maladjustment expresses itself during this planetary period of misuse as disease. And can we say are bacteria members of the vegetable kingdom? Okay, that's well, that's interesting. Really interesting. Things long forgotten are again coming to light. And maybe for you too, you know. It's been a while for me, and I admit, this amazing material. So, badly adjusted, because the energy of matter is the governing factor. Okay. Well, let's look at that. In the human kingdom, the working of this badly adjusted energy works out as selfishness. We see so much of it, and it is based on materialism and ignorance. In the animal kingdom, it demonstrates in what we call cruelty, though where the sense of responsibility is non-existent and only instinctual and temporary parental responsibility is found, there is no criticism to be given. You know, you understand that the male lion can kill its own cubs, the crocodile can eat its own hatchlings. I guess we would call that cruelty, but there is no sense of responsibility and no self-consciousness. In the vegetable kingdom, disease. He's not talking yet about the mineral kingdom. Let's see what he says. This surprises you. Disease has its roots in maladjustment and directed force in the vegetable kingdom. This affects the animal kingdom and mineral kingdom, and subsequently the human. It is far too ahead. It is too far ahead for this to be demonstrated. But when the condition is understood, it will be in that kingdom and nature that the attention of the investigators must be focused, and the eradication of disease will eventually find its solution. Well, that's not something that I would have thought. It's not in the front of my mind, I'll tell you that, but now it is. Disease has its roots primarily in maladjustments and misdirected force in the vegetable kingdom. This affects the animal, that we can understand, and mineral kingdoms. Maybe as the minerals are drawn into the diseased plant, something untoward happens, and subsequently, the human. I mean, we're supposed to get nourishment from the vegetable kingdom, and maybe the way the mineral kingdom is affected, we don't. This can't be demonstrated right now, but we will look to the vegetable kingdom for that. Okay. Well, friends, I would love to continue right now. Just getting warmed up here. But this has to be the end because we have a glamour workshop coming on. So we have We have pronounced, yeah, that's right. We have dealt with the confining of the lives within the ensphering wall, and we've dealt with the formula which confines the lives. So we have thus far dealt with the formula which confines the constituent lives within the ensphering wall. And constituent lives within the ensphering wall. So let us, go back here just a moment to right, Treatise on White Magic, and we'll just go down to number 11. There it is. First, ascertain the formula which will confine the lives within the ensphering wall. That is what we have dealt with thus far. Are we any the wiser for it? You know, I hope so. And if we repeat our studies and go deeper, we will be wiser. So, what page are we on? I can only make this a two-hour program, regretfully. I'd like to charge on, if possible. We're on page 463, and I wonder if we began on 457. Yeah, apparently. Okay, so this is 2463. Good. All right. Now we'll go down here. You can bear with me here. This is just a little bit of orientation. It's right before the second sentence. And we're here beginning. This has been 457 to 463. It's rule 11, and it has been number 2, and we're going to start on number 3. It has been number 55, and we're going to start on number 56. And we'll just begin with 463 and hope for the best. And it's going to be the third program on Rule 11. Okay, I think that ought to do it. Thank you very much for thinking through this with me. I mean, I always hope for greater clarity, always. But it's necessary to keep moving, you know. Progress onward, driving forward through space, all that. We have to keep moving, and we could ponder one thing for a long time. It's necessary. But we also want to get this overview and the kinds of associations which may arise as we pursue this more inclusive view of the relations of all the factors involved. So thank you, and study hard and apply. I speak to myself as I speak to you. Bye-bye.